there's so many voices and stories of people who have been trapped in the practices of imprisonment that we've had in this country for the last two decades that we just don't hear. And I just deeply believe that we need to let the stories rise to the surface so that we can actually see the world that we've built.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight we are honored to welcome Daniel Allen, director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard. She's going to be talking about her new book, Cuz. Professor Allen is a classicist and political theorist who's written books on topics ranging from Plato to good citizenship and democracy. In her latest book, however, she has turned her attention to the US justice system and most particularly to the plight of young black offenders behind bars. Her subject is a very personal one and deals with the events leading up to the untimely death of her young cousin Michael at the age of 29 on the streets of Los Angeles. Allen examines the deadly double helix of narcotics and street gangs which entrapped Michael, along with countless others, and eventually led to his incarceration and death. What could have been done differently, and does the current justice system merely perpetuate the injustices it is designed to address? I'm pleased to present Professor Daniel Allen.
When I came to graduate school at Harvard in 1996, it was just a couple of months after my baby cousin had been sentenced to 12 years and 8 months in prison for an attempted carjacking on his first arrest. And this was a pretty devastating event, experience for our whole family. So what exactly is Michael's story? At the age of 15, he was arrested on a first arrest, as I said, for an attempted carjacking. On his way to the hospital, so his victim got his gun and shot him. And on his way to the hospital, he confessed to also having robbed three people the previous day and another person a week earlier. So one has to be forthright and say this was a spree of violent activity. It also came out of nowhere. There was no history of behavior of this kind from Michael or for Michael. And as I said, it was a first arrest. But because it was California in 1995, and California had recently passed the three strikes, you're out law, and they had been routinely lowering the age at which somebody could be tried as an adult, a juvenile could be tried as an adult, Michael came to trial against that background, and he had two felony charges from the attempted carjacking. And people often don't realize you can get more than one felony in a single incident. So the whole sort of three strikes, you're out idea. It's like you can actually get all, you know, a bunch of strikes in one go. So he had a felony for having asked his victim for the watch and the wallet, and he had a felony for the car. Then he also had two felonies from the robberies he confessed to. The police had records for two. They charged him with two. So he was told by the judge if he went to trial and was convicted on these four things he'd confessed to, he would be facing 25 years to life on the basis of the three strikes, you're out law. So he pled guilty and took 13 years and ended up serving 11 of those years. So he got out when he was 26, and I was, as I say, about sort of the cousin on duty when he got out. We spent a lot of time together during his years in prison on the phone, with correspondence courses and things like that. There are lots of family members around trying to help. At any rate, so I was there working the summer that he got out on the sort of pieces, sort of basic building blocks of life. Michael and I, the whole family, were working hard on his new life, and it ended 3 years after he was first released because he was killed by his girlfriend, the woman, transgender woman he'd met in prison during that 11-year stint. And Michael's story is one that our family, as I say, has this huge impact, but a terrible thing to say about it is, after he died, we never talked about what happened to him. So everybody has a tragedy in their family. Everybody has the problem of family secrets. And I want to just say something about that, because a lot of this story seems to be a story about family secrets, what it takes for people to break through shame about events of this kind in order to talk about them and find the truth. And we've got family secrets in my family, the big old extended family of Allens, but we also have family secrets in the country. And I'll come back around to that in a minute. But I want to just introduce you to Michael, let you hear his voice a little bit, and then I'll come back around to the secrets and the questions that had to be answered. So Michael was this beautiful, precocious, energetic, curious kid, loved to be outdoors, super talkative, motor mouth with a stammer. So he always felt as if he just had so much he was discovering about the world and wanted to share it, couldn't quite all get out fast enough. And he was the beloved youngest child, the son, third child of this big extended family's youngest daughter. So my dad had 11 brothers and sisters, and his baby sister Karen, the youngest of them, had three kids. And her three kids and my brother and I, we grew up together in Southern California. Very different circumstances. I grew up as a faculty brat. Karen and her kids grew up in the world of a struggling single mother, inching her way up, working incredibly hard, never enough time or money to quite pull things together, yet they were as a much part of the fabric of our extended family, had the resources of love and so forth of all of us. And the five of us spent a lot of time together as kids. We thought of ourselves as a single unit within this big extended family. So I just want to give you a little flavor of, again, that sort of those early years. Karen inched her way up to a nursing degree. She got a little house for them in Highland Park outside of Pasadena, where they were for 5 years. And that was really five good years. So let me just read you a little bit about that. In Highland Park, the rites of passage proceeded according to plan. Michael's beautiful kindergarten teacher, the one with the blonde afro, loved him. He graduated in high style in a white cap and gown. He had gymnastics lessons and played Little League and went to summer camp. To raise the funds for camp, he sold peanuts, so successfully even that he funded his brothers and sisters' trips to camp, too. The trio would go for 3 week stints in the summer, then they would come home. Their mother would do their laundry, and then she would send them off again. They always went together. Michael also had a glorious bicycle, a He-Man bike, that he loved, and their house was on top of a hill. He would slide down it barefoot, not yet able to brake, ending up at least once with a swollen eye, with the bike all bent out of shape, having terrified his sister, cousins, mother, anyone who was around. His sister, who was growing into a large-bodied girl and had already developed a mothering instinct, would cry out, "Michael, why don't you put no shoes on?" We visited them often in this house. Once a month, from 6th to 8th grade, I would come by so Big Roz's girlfriend, my other aunt and her girlfriend, could relax my hair. So the title of the book, Cuz, just came to me, just out of the blue, one of those divine moments of inspiration. Because that's what Michael called me. He called me Cuz, because it means cousin, of course. But also because I realized what was killing me was the why questions. Why was he dead? Why had he been in prison for so long? And the hardest one of all, why had this beautiful, bright kid from his beloved kid in a huge extended family, why had he ended up on a street corner at the age of 15 trying to take someone's gun? And the book is an effort to answer all of those questions. And a part of the answer comes from what happened when his mother, when he was 10, his mother met a man who turned out to be abusive, and everything just exploded in their world. Everything came apart. They moved, he was in 5 different schools in 5 years. They moved from California to Mississippi to Georgia, then back to California again. His school transitions were often mid-year transitions. And those were those years, 10 to 14. Just remember for yourself what it's like to be 10 to 14. It just sucks for everybody, regardless of the circumstances. And imagine the degree of difficulty that you add to that when you're having those movements, the isolation, the disconnection from a world. Now, one of the terrible things about working on this book for me was that although we all could see the movement and we could see the disruption, it wasn't until I was working on this book that we learned that my aunt and my cousins had been abused. All right, so again, sort of back to the issue of shame and the way it keeps people from telling what's happening to them. And the result of that being those of us who care didn't see enough to help. And that was our failing also, not to have pushed and asked the right questions to understand. But breaking through the silence is a key thing to avoiding, I think, these kinds of difficulties. So Michael's life exploded, and he ended up in South Central. coming into South Central as a stranger. In the early 90s, massive increase in gang homicides, violence in general, and the incredible ratcheting up of penal severity in Southern California. And this is a story about the war on drugs and how we fought it, the relationship between gangs and drugs, not anywhere nearly as self-evident as we take it to be. So in that time of the early 90s, researchers have been able to show that roughly half of the drug transactions in Los Angeles were connected to gangs, but police, when they were asked to estimate the number, would say 90 to 95%. And the result of those kinds of mistakes was that the war on drugs became a war on gangs. I'll say more about that in a minute. But the point is just that it was an incredibly dangerous environment. And when I was working on this book, I was talking to another cousin named Peely, who lived around the corner from where Michael landed. Peely lived in a Bloods neighborhood. And I said to Peely, you know, how is it, you know, you made it out in the context of a great degree of difficulty here. He's a professional in Los Angeles. Like, what was the difference between your experience and Michael's experience? And his answer was, this was a world in which if you came up in one neighborhood, you just were understood to be a part of that group, the Bloods, Denver Lane Bloods in his case. You didn't have to do anything to prove your loyalty, so you could skirt around the edges of that world and stay safe. But if you landed there as a stranger and didn't have any affiliations, you were obliged to declare your affiliations to prove yourself. And Michael landed there late 13 and over the course of 18 months began to flirt with both Bloods and Crips, which is this incredibly dangerous thing to do. And again, little pieces of information, but nobody in our family put the story together. And so, for example, it turns out there's a third meaning of cuz, which, again, I didn't know until I was working on this book. Some of you will know. Cuz is also what members of the Crips call each other. So Peely, who grew up in the Bloods neighborhood, had heard Michael starting to call him cuz, and it gave him chills. It was very upsetting to me. So how could Michael call me this? He knows where I live. And so, but Peely never shared that piece of information. And so although Michael was flirting with gangs at the end of this time, again, none of us saw this. His mother didn't know this until I was doing this work on this book and put all of the pieces together. Okay, so now, Michael, as I said, he was a bright kid. He wanted to go to college. He spent a lot of time in prison doing college work. I wanted just to give you a little more of his voice, read you a part of his essay about Dante's Inferno. And like Dante, I am forced to descend lower into hell to achieve a full awakening. I am forced into depression, scarred by obscenities, war after war. But each war that I survive, I am a step closer to a full awakening of self. My hell is no longer demonstrating what I am capable of doing in order to survive. It has become what I can tolerate and withstand in order to live. I cannot help but to judge those around me. I am one of them, but we are far from the same. Like Dante, I am cursed with the spirit of discernment, which allows us to see the truth for what it is. There are most whom I despise who are truly sick beyond healing, and they should never leave this place. Then there are those who await to fulfill their destiny. I see in them a sincere and apologetic heart for their ill misdeeds. They are the ones who will change the world positively or positively change someone's world. Hell cannot hold the latter of the two opposites, but in time will only spit them back out into society to do what is right. The hell that I live in cannot hold Dante. Hell can test and try oneself, but it cannot hold Dante, and it will not hold me. In the inferno, the dead are trapped forever. Surely the biggest and most important difference in the inferno and my hell called prison is that I have a way out. Now, I wanted you to hear Michael's voice, not actually because his voice is special necessarily, it's special to me and to my family, but this voices like this is what our prisons are full of. And this is where I want to switch from talking about the family secrets and the problem of shame that blocked my family from seeing what was going on to the bigger problem of the family secret that we share as a society. Okay? So, yes, Michael's choices, bad choices on that street corner, put him in prison. And our family's failure to care for him in a coordinated way, with full knowledge about what was happening to him, put him in prison. But so too did the world that we as a society have built with our criminal justice system. And I want to talk about that family secret to try to flesh this out the rest of the way. So, you know, I don't actually have to tell you, you all here are well aware of our family secret. It's got a couple of different parts. The first is, the world has never seen a penal system like the one we've built in this country. Like, I can say that because I'm a classicist, and I have studied punishment in antiquity, and I take the long view and the world view of the question. So the penal system that we've built, where this country has 5% of the world's population and 25% of the people in prison, is completely a Made in America special. The news is getting out, but it has been a family secret for too long. And it has been a family secret as it has been building. But the other part of the family secret is the relationship between that fact and the war on drugs, which is, again, I know people sitting here generally know, but I still think it's worth spelling out. Okay, because oftentimes when you are asked about mass incarceration and people say, well, what are the drivers of mass incarceration? And some say, well, the war on drugs. And people say, well, let's release all the nonviolent drug offenders from prison. The result of doing that would be that about 14% of people would be released. And so people turn to me and say, well, look, you know, so ending the war on drugs won't make that much of a difference. It's just 14% of people who would be released. I'm like, wow, I'll take 14%. That's, you know, I'll take that. I'm not going to complain about that. But let's think about it for a minute. If we think about it, we realize that the war on drugs has had a lot of other effects too. So I always like to stop and ask, who knows how much money Americans spend out of pocket every year on illegal drugs? Anybody know? Now that's a family secret if we don't know. $100 billion. $100 billion a year, every year for the last decade, all right? That's $100 billion worth of desire that we have in this country that we don't admit to, okay? That with our legal system, we pretend it's not there. Now that's an awful lot of material, a big economy, and of course, an illegal economy of that scale generates a lot of violence. So you have a lot of violence associated with the war on drugs, which also puts people in prison. But then there's other pieces of this. So in 2013, just take one small statistic, 32% of new filings in federal courts were drug-related filings. Okay, now what does that mean? That means prosecutorial workloads are swollen by dealing with drug cases. And when prosecutors' workloads are swollen in that way, they don't actually have the time to devote to cases that aren't open and shut in, say, the homicide category. That's the anecdotal account on the part of police. And when they don't deal with cases in that category, you get a reduction in homicide clearance rates. So in the middle of the 20th century, homicide clearance rates across the country were about 90%. That means cases closed for homicide. They've come down to 50%, 60%. In Detroit, before its bankruptcy, it was in the teens. Okay? Now, the point of this, so there are some economists who've explained what's going on with violence in urban areas and contexts like that. And one of the points they make is that when those clearance rates come down, it's not just that there's a sort of world of retribution or lawlessness, but there's a whole phase shift in violence. And the reason there's a phase shift is because if you know somebody can attack you and go unpunished, your best defense is a strong offense. And all the levels of violence shift upwards. So that's another chunk of the activity that gets captured in the criminal justice system. But then there's a few other things too. Let's not forget that once you decide that somebody should be locked up for a year for simple possession of marijuana, or for somewhere between a year and 5 years for simple possession of crack and cocaine or heroin or whatever, every other sentence is going to have to shift longer to maintain any sense of proportionality between violent crimes and nonviolent crimes, which means you're going to have a kid on a first arrest for an attempted carjacking where the only person who got hurt was himself, being presented with the possibility of 25 years to life. Okay? So there's a corruption that has come in from the war on drugs. And then the last little turn of the screw here that I want to put out there is, so the state wants to fight the distribution of drugs, and it does this by targeting its incredible power on the distributors, the low-level street distributors of narcotics. Well, what is the result of that? Well, the folks who are running this $100 billion business don't want to lose control of their distributors. So they're going to themselves counteract the efforts of the state with their own systems of deterrence, structures of sanctions and penalties in the world of gangs and drug delivery. And the result is a huge increase of violence, as there's, in effect, a war between the state and the parastate, I argue. Okay? And when you've got this going on, you've got kids in cities exposed to huge amounts of violence in all kinds of contexts who need protection. They need protection. And what do gangs offer? They offer protection. So boom, the state hits the parastate. Boom, the parastate hits back. And who suffers? The kids. The kids. And it's because of our collective family secret that we're not telling the truth about the world that we're building. I also like to use the idea of degree of difficulty to talk about this issue of how do we put individual responsibility and social responsibility in relationship to each other. So I was particularly struck by this last summer watching the Olympics. I don't know who else watches the Olympics, but there was this gymnast from India, I think Kara Makar was her name, and she was doing this maneuver on the vault called the, I think it's the Pradra Nova, but I'm probably getting that wrong. Anyway, you guys clearly don't have the same obsession with gymnastics as I do. But this is this maneuver, which is, it's the highest degree of difficulty in gymnastics, and it's the kind of degree of difficulty where you either make it or you break your back. Right, that's it. It's like the whole coverage was like, is she gonna break her back? Is she gonna break her back? Is she gonna break her back? Like that was what the news coverage was about. So she made it. Great. Okay, yes, people can make it in circumstances that have the highest degree of difficulty. But the fact of the matter is that one person makes it and most people break their backs. And the issue of the degree of difficulty that a young kid faces, that's where our responsibility kicks in. We as society, we with our laws, with our institutional structures, have established a world with very disparate degrees of difficulty facing kids. That's one of the messages I'm trying to share by sharing Michael's story. So I want to just give you one last example, I suppose, of the way in which the problems of shame block honesty about what we've built with prisons and the experience of them. Just a little bit more. A chapter called Visiting 1.0. Okay, so I'll just read a little bit. As Michael, known to the system as K1033, wrote, inmates went by numbers, not names, and visiting days were allocated to sets of numbers, half of the evens on one Saturday, half of the odds on Sunday, the other halves of each set the following week. Before you could even begin to visit, you first had to apply for permission to enter. You had to get your name on the list. This could take months. And then the visits themselves were odysseys. We generally set out at about 4 or 5 in the morning, in the half dark of pre-dawn, and drove straight toward the rising sun in order to get to the prison by 6:30 a.m. There we would join the line of waiting cars snaking from the parking lot past a row of suburban baseball fields that bordered the prison. This was a good time for heart-to-hearts between Karen and me. At 7:30 a.m., the guards would let a parade of Kias and Hyundais, Chevys and Dodges into the parking lot. And then you would sign in at a lectern at the front of a canopied structure with wooden benches that looked something like a tent revival meeting. Hosts of mainly black and brown women, but white women too, and many children, and some men, flitted in the shadows under the canopy. We could take in up to $30 in quarters or singles in plastic baggies, and we always took the maximum. The point of this was to purchase treats for the inmates from the row of vending machines dispensing, as it turned out, quite disgusting microwavable cheeseburgers and burritos, along with mystery meat plates. It also mattered how you dressed. You couldn't wear blue denim because that's what the inmates wore. You couldn't wear beige or khaki because that's what the guards wore. You couldn't wear tight clothes or clothes that showed cleavage or skirts shorter than 2 inches above the knee or sleeves shorter than 2 inches below the shoulder. If you were dressed wrong, you weren't let in. You always took a backup set of clothes just in case. If there was a focal point of the control, I suppose it was the attempt to target desire. All right, so my editor kept coming round and round and round to this chapter. He kept saying, but you don't tell us about you and your experience. Like, what do you mean? I kept saying, all this detail, like the $30 and singles, and I'm giving all kinds of texture, things I saw and observed. And he kept coming back to this point. And if you were listening, you probably heard it. So all the way through the book, I say I talk about my experience. In that chapter, I said you. Did you hear it? Did you notice? And I realized, when it suddenly light bulb went off, that even this far into writing the book, I couldn't talk about what going to prison meant to me. So I had to write another chapter, Visiting 2.0, right? Time for my own confession. I wrote that last chapter like an academic, which I am. The description of visiting that I gave you wasn't about me, it was about some disembodied you. To write that chapter, I stepped into the perspective of an outside observer, the luxury afforded to academics when they travel the world encountering pain and injustice. To be an academic is to acquire an excuse for not owning the pain you see. Abstraction, distancing, those are my first tools of self-protection, Athena's spear and shield. I will have to try again to describe what visiting Michael meant to me. The fact that I told the story as an academic already tells you everything you need to know. That wound of visiting Michael in prison goes so deep that somehow, even in writing this book, I have found it hard to own up to one simple fact. I went to prison. I was in prison. No, I don't mean that I have been arrested or convicted of a crime. I have avoided that because thus far in life, I have had that combination of goods that the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle thought was necessary for a happy life. Resources, decent character, and luck. My father and mother gave me the first two items from that treasure chest, the Lord my God, whom I believed in as a child, and then did not believe in, and then came to believe in again as I emerged from periods of great pain, has given me the third. All right. So now you know more about me than anybody other than my husband. My second husband, that is. Our wedding took place barely a month before Michael's murder. But no, I was not in prison as a convict, and this is thanks to my father, my mother, and my God. Yet even as someone who could come and go, I felt the prison's mark, its branding fork. I felt it in my soul. Even though all I was there was a day's sojourner. Thank you.
You've been listening to Deadly Double Helix, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square in September 2017 with Professor Daniel Allen, director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University and author of Cuz, a memoir. Thanks for joining us, and please come again.